All right, you guys. Hey, welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Good to have you on. Ah, crap. I'm a blog entry behind here, ain't I? Can I do a blog entry live on the show and make it not sound too bad? Yeah, I think I can. Today on the show, Nebojsa Malic. Well, it's not my fault he doesn't have an H at the end of his name. How am I supposed to know how to say it? What am I, from Serbia? No, I'm an Austinite. Nebojsa Malic and Jonathan Lande. Late last night, somebody tweeted me the new Lande. I had just asked him, hey, man, can you do Iraq on the show? And he had said, no, I'm sorry, I'm working Ukraine. And then, blam, I guess he just gets a lot of work done, because then he turned right around and got some Iraq work done. And someone tweeted me this article last night, and it's all about what all did the administration know about ISIS and their preparations for a full-scale invasion of northwestern Iraq, and when did they know it? And what did or didn't they do about it? And he gets all into the background of the arming of the rebels in Syria and all that. And now Lande, he's a hard-ass reporter, but he's got kind of a conventional view of a lot of how these things work and are supposed to work sometimes. So it's going to be an interesting thing parsing with him about moderate rebels to back versus just staying out of it, or sod, whatever. And I'm going to try to mostly just get the reporting out of him. Maybe a little argument at the end. But it's a very in-depth article. And, yeah, anyway, very interesting stuff from McClatchy Newspapers. Jonathan Lande will be on the show. And that's, yeah, starting now. Malik, of course, will be on to talk about Malich. Will be on to talk about Ukraine. And then, of course, I have a bunch of Gaza news. But I don't have any Gaza guests. I've been trying all day. I swear I've been trying all day to get on some good Gaza guests for you guys. But the good news is that I have someone else working on it for me now. Remember we talked to Diana Boutu, who is a lawyer. I think she's an Israeli Arab, but an Israeli citizen. And she's a lawyer, and she's a human rights lawyer here in the U.S., I think. As well as a former spokesman for Fatah and or the PLO. I'm not sure exactly how that parses. Those, I think those are not exactly synonyms, but they're used interchangeably all the time. I don't know, whatever. Anyway, remember we talked to her. She was great. You might have seen her on CNN too. Well, her secretary, I guess, is going to try to help me find someone else. Her assistant is going to help try to find me someone else on the show today to talk about this stuff. So, there you go. Otherwise, I have a ton of news to cover for you, and it should be a pretty good show. I better log into the chat room. Hadn't gotten around to that all day yet here. All you gotta do is make up a fake name and put in the CAPTCHA. And by the way, the CAPTCHAs are real easy, at least for me lately. It's been giving me all numbers, photos of addresses, which is a lot better than sometimes the real twisty-turny crazy kind of CAPTCHA where you really can't tell if that's supposed to be an N or a R, and you get sick and tired of trying over and over again. This is real easy. You just put in a fake name, put in the CAPTCHA, simple CAPTCHA, and you're in scotthorton.org/chat. Hey, everybody, I already got a good group of people in there hanging out today. So what do you know? Should be a good time in there. All right. Now, so the first thing I have to say on the show is I'm a little bit embarrassed because our friend Nima Vadavi, formerly, of the Freedom Fiends, he went and made a YouTube video out of my debunking of the Dennis Prager thing, which is cool, and thank you very much, and he actually did a really good job and spliced in some good footage and whatever. But, you know, the truth is, I wasn't really prepared. It was just sort of a one-off thing on the show. I had some notes. It doesn't compare to the production that went into Prager's whole thing. I mean, he had a practiced script with all of his omissions excluded and everything ready to go. I was sort of going off the top of my head, mostly. I jotted down a couple of notes, but mostly I was going off the top of my head and just kind of in reaction to him. So it was far from me making the case for the Palestinians or any kind of thing like that. I was just trying to go through and point out the holes in his story. But anyway, I saw a pro-Israel comment under that YouTube. And yeah, he had a good point, really, that I did not have my act together. On the other hand, all of his points, he did not have a point. You know, and he was trying to basically criticize what I was saying. I think, and this is the lesson that the world is learning, certainly the Twitterverse is learning, is that when it comes down to arguments, the pro-Israel factions really don't have any. What they have are a bunch of piece of crap talking points that don't hold up whatsoever. Oh, human shields, human shields, human shields. Well, wait a minute now. Is that supposed to be an accusation that Hamas are a bunch of really bad guys? Look at them hiding behind their families. Never mind that there's no proof of that, right? And you kill a man in his home and say that he's holding his family hostage, then you're just a killer and a liar. What are you talking about? But assuming even that Hamas is deliberately going around, you know, with little kids tied to their backs, to try to prevent, you know, protect themselves or some crap like that. What do the Israelis mean? And what are the Israelis' partisans, the Amen Corner here in America and on Twitter and everywhere else, all the neocons and their acolytes? What's their point? That Hamas are bad guys? Or that it's okay to kill these kids? Because, after all, it's Hamas's fault that they're in the line of fire. The latter. And we can all see that. Oh, human shields becomes a very thin excuse for massacring civilians by the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. You know, this guy said, one of my points was, you notice how Prager just never even stops to even admit for a moment that, yes, there are millions of Palestinians. And it is kind of a complicated thing of what should be done here or whatever. He doesn't even say that. And that's a major criticism of mine. And this guy arguing in the comments there, and I know YouTube comments are the lowest form of debate, and so I probably shouldn't bother. But anyway, you know, his comment is, yeah, but everybody knows that or something. And so, you know, come on, the starting point of the discussion starts after that. Well, no, pardon me. You know, if I was doing anything like the opposite video, which I actually don't have necessarily a pro-Palestinian argument to make. But if I was doing a pro-Palestinian video, in fact, even in my anti-Prager video, or it wasn't a video, it was a clip of this radio show, which is a live show, and again, not a big scripted, perfected, edited thing. But even in there, I tried to, you know, give as much credibility to Prager's argument as I could before, you know, making my case against it. Yeah, no, he's right that X, but still Y, something like that. But he's not as honest as that. He's not honest enough to even admit the Palestinians are people. The only time he references Palestinians at all, he's talking about terrorist group leadership. That's it. There are no refugees. There are no people suffering. You know, he never talks about the occupation, never talks about the colonies on the West Bank, the settlements, never talks about now finally cutting off East Jerusalem completely from the rest of the West Bank, bulldozing ancient cemeteries to build museums of tolerance. No, really, that happened. I couldn't make that up as a lie. That would be such a stupid lie. I would hate some stupid idiot that came up with some stupid lie like that. But no, it's true. I read all about it in the Jerusalem Post. They really bulldozed an ancient cemetery to build a museum of tolerance on top of it. You know, a monument to Israeli victimhood. He doesn't talk about any of that. He doesn't concede the Palestinians are even there to be victims in his entire argument. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com. Howdy, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Nebojsa Malik coming up on the show from antiwar.com. And Jonathan Landay from McClatchy Newspapers on the Islamic State. I don't know, man. I felt a whole paranoid ISIS rant coming on there. I suppressed it for a minute. I'll save it for the Landay interview coming up. Let me tell you about the Oklahoma bombing here real quick. Timothy McVeigh had friends, okay? And I'm not a kook, and I'm not a maniac, and that's just true. There's a great new book. If you need the most mainstream type official sort of pat on the head that you could get in order to allay your cognitive dissonance about the basic legitimacy of our system and the checks and balances within it and that kind of thing, I'll refer you to the book Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed and Why It Matters by Andrew Gumbel and Roger Charles. Now, the thing about that book is that Andrew Gumbel, he's a British reporter who's perfectly welcome at the New America Foundation, which is Steve Clemens' foundation, which is very, very conventional in Democrat times. Peter Bergen, of CNN fame, of interviewed Osama bin Laden in 1996 fame, is one of their senior fellows there and does all their, counterterrorism stuff. You see Peter Bergen on CNN all the time. You know exactly what I'm talking about. Again, very mainstream, official, accepted experts in the fields of, for example, terrorism, that kind of thing. And this guy, Andrew Gumbel, if you go to YouTube, you can find Andrew Gumbel sitting in a chair at the New America Foundation talking for approximately an hour or maybe even an hour and a half with Peter Bergen all about this, and you'll see that it ain't kookery. This is just, the rest of the story that they never admitted. And in fact, in the book, there's an entire section of a chapter about the debate inside the FBI and the Department of Justice, which, it's amazing. I learned so much from this, actually. I just picture the evil, Bill Clinton and Janet Reno and Webster Hubble going, we must cover up the real truth and exploit this for gun control purposes and blood dripping from their fangs and that kind of thing, because it's so easy to picture them that way, right? And who knows who told Bill Clinton what, off the record or on it or what, I don't really know, but they just make it so clear that there was an argument at the Department of Justice. It's like you could picture this as any other bureaucratic argument. Should we focus only on Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols in order to secure our convictions that we're really, really after? Or should we go ahead and follow the investigation wherever it leads, which might end up generating Brady material and could jeopardize the prosecution of this one SOB who we really, really, really want to convict? McVeigh, the poster boy, the driver of the truck, and so, therefore, much deserving of prosecution and conviction and even the death penalty he ended up getting for it. And they decided, as a bureaucratic matter, we have to cover up the fact that all of McVeigh's friends were actually undercover FBI informants, or at least former informants, or flip states witnesses, or on one way or the other had compromised the FBI as much as the FBI had compromised them in their crappy Nazi lives. And so we better cover that up, guys. It actually, it seems a lot more like, well, geez, if we admit that more people did it, then that might cause reasonable doubt as to who made McVeigh do it and these kinds of things. And we don't want loose ends in our big trial. We just want to keep it simple. And I know that it sounds like an oversimplification, but I think that actually, it rings really true to me too. It was so straightforward of a bureaucratic kind of maneuver that it almost amounts to not a conspiracy to cover up the attack. But of course, I mean almost, when I say almost. Because the truth is, the FBI and the Department of Justice let murderers get away with murder. 169 counts of murder. 169 counts of murder. And they let them get away with it. And they let them get away with it. I don't know. So they could get their McVeigh conviction? So that they could cover up the fact that Andre Strassmeyer wasn't even really a Nazi at all, but was just pretending to be a Nazi because he was working for the CIA? Or maybe, I don't know, launder him through the DEA kind of thing, you know. Was that the major reason for the cover-up? Andre Strassmeyer's employment, the involvement of the Nazis at Elohim City, and their links to American intelligence agencies? Was that it? I don't know. But here's what I know. I accuse, at least, you know, at a grand jury level, I'm not saying I could get convictions, but I think I could get indictments. I think that Andrew Gumbel and Roger Charles could get indictments against Michael Brescia and Mark Thomas and Peter Langan and what's his name, the guy with the brown pickup truck from Arizona, the gold miner from Arizona. Guthrie, of course, was murdered in his cell. I think Guthrie was probably the most likely John Doe number two. Anyway, here's the thing. The Oklahoma City bombing video trial starts next week in Utah because Richard Guthrie, who I just mentioned, was murdered. He died. He was murdered, made to look like a suicide in federal prison, just like Kenneth Trenadue, who in fact looked just like Richard Guthrie. And you can read lots of different things about this. There's a great speech actually by Kenneth's brother, Jesse, who is doing the suing here. It's a wonderful speech. It's just so good, where he lays out exactly what the hell is going on here. Anyway, what he tells the story is his brother Kenneth looked exactly like Richard Guthrie. Same red-headed mullet, same massive upper body build, same red pickup truck, was coming back from Mexico, where Guthrie was said to have possibly fled to. And Kenneth was even formerly a bank robber. So, which this was all tied up with the Aryan Republican Army neo-Nazi bank robbery ring. And so the feds convinced themselves that this was one and the same guy. Richard Guthrie and Kenneth Trenadue must be the same guy. And perhaps in trying to beat Kenneth into admitting that it was true, they killed him. And he was a tough guy. And he apparently fought back like a wild man against his murderers, but they ended up lynching his ass in his federal prison cell. Killed him dead. Had nothing to do with the Aryan bank robbers, whatever, whatever. It was simply a case of mistaken identity. And I believe that that was why they killed him. I think Jesse believes that's why they killed him, is they thought he was Richard Guthrie, McVeigh's accomplice in the Oklahoma bombing. Apparently Timothy McVeigh thought that too. But anyway, next week, the heroic Jesse Trenadue, his brother's avenger, goes on trial to get the suppressed video of the bombing, which shows McVeigh with his main accomplice. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richmond, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of the Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for the Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's the Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richmond at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me, you heard it here. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our first guest today is Nebojša Malič. He writes for antiwar.com. He's been writing for antiwar.com for 14 years, since the year 2000. The Balkan Express is the name of his column. Oh, no, that used to be. Now it's Moments of Transition. I knew that. Moments of Transition. And the new one coming out tomorrow, I believe, is a clash of civilizations from Fukuyama to Huntington. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Nebojša?
Thanks, Scott. It's good to be back.
Good. Very happy to have you here. And I guess I apologize to the audience. I got cicadas and chirping birds outside, and it's not much of a radio studio in here today. But, you know, it sounds in nature is better than a jackhammer. So. Anyway, very happy to have you back on the show here. There's so much controversy going on in Ukraine right now, and especially over this plane. And, you know, I'm just guessing that you know everything about it. I know you're paying a hell of a lot more attention to it than I am. And I was hoping that you could just go over what all is known and what all is not known about the shoot down of the plane in eastern Ukraine, Nebojsa.
Well,
to start here.
Right. Well, as the case may be, I've just finished up a blog post about that, entitled "It's Some Basic Police Work." You know, anybody who's grown up in the United States and watched tons of police procedurals knows about the holy trifecta of means, motives, and opportunity, right? So who had the means, the motives, and the opportunity to shoot down this plane? And all of the indicators point to the one party that has not been named as a suspect in the Western mainstream media, that has never been mentioned as a suspect, that has never been mentioned at all in this context, aside from a source of quote-unquote reliable intelligence that turned out to be a couple of doctored YouTube videos. And that is the military junta in Kiev.
All right. Now, so let me say this before you get into making your case. Well, let me say a couple of things. First of all, I forgot to mention that your own blog is Gray Falcon, right?
That's correct.
Grayfalcon.blogspot.com. So it's MH17 and some basic police work there. I had to double check because I guess you changed the format. I just want to make sure it's still the same blog here.
Yes,
Gray
it
Falcon
is.
There. Okay. And so now here's my thing about it. And I think that the other side of the argument would have a strong case that nobody ever ascribed a deliberate, well, maybe some kook did or whatever, but I don't think the official narrative is to ascribe a malevolent motive to the rebels, that they would shoot down this plane just because they like shooting down civilians so much. It's that they must have thought that they were shooting down a military plane from Kiev, and they hit this thing by mistake. Just because they can fire a rocket doesn't necessarily mean that they can pick their target carefully enough to really make sure, and so it must have just been kind of a horrible screw-up. So in that sense, it sort of does it nullify the question of motive? Because let me say, just for me, when I first heard about it, sounds like the most plausible explanation is the rebels did it accidentally. And we can get into all the particulars of the missile and all that kind of thing. And then, I mean, obviously, as a false flag type of attack by Kiev to make the rebels look bad, to blame it on them, that's got to be, you know, I don't know, second or third or fourth on the list for plausible explanations. I certainly don't completely discount it, but doesn't seem like the one that comes first to mind. Seems like the Occam's razor answer is that the rebels did it accidentally. So what about that?
Well, and that's exactly what the propaganda's counting on. See, I'm not excluding the possibility, but the more evidence emerges and the more propaganda I see, the more unlikely that scenario seems to be. There were reports that the rebels had one of these missile systems, maybe one or two, they may be functional. You even had high-ranking U.S. officials going out of their way saying, well, even if they did have them, and there's no proof that they did, they don't have the training to operate them, so we think it might have been somebody else. And the whole thrust of the propaganda from the first minute of the plane coming down was Putin's missile. Russia did it. Russians are to blame. It's all the Russians' fault. It's just I couldn't believe my own eyes. I watched like the main three networks flipping the channels, and even the structure of their coverage was exactly the same. They would, you know, at the exact same time, they would switch to a human interest interviewee. They would tune into the reporter in Moscow. It was just incredible how synchronized they were. And again, they were pointing out, you know, the Russians, the pro-Russian rebels or however they called them. And they didn't mention a single time the possibility of the Ukrainian government being behind this. Now, let's consider the actual evidence. The Ukrainian army has the exact system that was blamed for the shootdown, Dubuk 1M, I believe it's named, the SA-11. they have not just – they don't just possess the launchers. They've deployed the launchers in the area like a week before. For what reason? I mean, the rebels don't have any air force. They were claiming, oh, we were protecting ourselves from the Russian air force. Right. Where's the proof that the Russians had ever flown in the area? There isn't any. Whatever. Okay, so they had these launchers. One of the explanations I heard, to be charitable here, is that they were using these surface-to-air missiles to engage ground targets. This is, these are not very precise missiles. They cause widespread devastation, lots of shrapnel. I'm not sure this is a weapon that's banned by conventions, but it comes very close. So either they're using them to fight non-existent Russian planes, they're using them to shoot civilian planes and blame it on the Russians, or they're shelling civilians with them. Take your pick. But those are the three possible uses behind the deployment of these launchers. Secondly,
and now let me stop you. Let me stop you there real quick. Is it conceded by the Western side that they do have these launchers, or that's only the Russian accusation? Which the Russians did show satellite footage, but
these are the systems that the Ukrainians had in their inventory. Mm-hmm. At independence in 1994, and the Ukrainian media have shown pictures of them around Ukraine. Okay. The famous picture of the alleged rebel launcher being scurried back to Russia was taken at a Ukrainian-held town that is west of the rebel-held territory and nowhere near Russia.
Right. Well, wait.
So they do have them.
I want to let you get back to that the picture of so-called picture evidence and all that in just a moment here. But I just wanted to make sure about when the Russians said, look, we have satellite pictures of these kinds of missiles in Ukrainian hands, in the area or relatively near, which is the same thing that Robert Perry's CIA sources are telling him, apparently. Did the U.S. push back on that and say, no, that's not true? Or did they not try to dispute the Russian assertion that the Ukrainians sure did have missiles like this nearby?
They didn't address any of it directly. They essentially had the State Department spokesperson tell the reporters that she has super secret intelligence that she can't, she can't divulge the source.
Was her last name Bush?
It's Harf, but yeah, go figure. She said, "Oh, I've got this proof from the intelligence community, and I worked in there for 6 years, so trust me. We have evidence that this is not true, but I can't show it to you." And every time that the reporters pressed her on it, one specific reporter, in fact, she would say, oh, well, between the super secret intelligence and social media, we're the ones telling the truth and the Russians are lying.
Right.
And when pressed by Matt Lee from AP, she said, yes, I'm saying that everything the Russians say is a lie and everything we tell you is the truth because we're not in the business of manufacturing propaganda. And that is a bald-faced lie.
I mean, you can't help but think of Adlai Stevenson and all of this thing when people start deploying their satellite pictures. Oh, you say you don't have missiles in Cuba, huh? Well, what's that then? And the Russians are just completely embarrassed. They're called out in front of the whole world, and that's it. And it's the greatest thing that ever happened in Adlai Stevenson's pathetic life and blah, 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 right? And so that was what Colin Powell was trying to compare to in 2002 and 3. And here the Russians have said, here are our satellite photos. What about that, America? And America can't say nothing other than, well, we have secret satellite photos that we can't show you that say otherwise. The Soviets had more honor than that when it came to questions like this. We got to take this break. We'll be right back with Nebojsa Malich in just a second. He's at antiwar.com/Malich. Admit it, our public debate has been reduced to reading each other's bumper stickers. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. I made up most of them, and most of those when I was mad as hell about something. So if you hate war, empire, central banking, cops, Republicans, Democrats, gun grabbers, and status of all stripes, go to LibertyStickers.com, and there's a good chance you'll find just what you need for the back of your truck. Own a bookstore? Sell guns at the show? Get the wholesaler's deal. Buy any 100 stickers and they drop down in price to $1 a piece. You can spread the contempt and make a little money too. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Nebojsa Malich from antiwar.com and from the blog Gray Falcon. And we're talking about still this mystery, seems like, of the shoot down of the Malaysian airliner over eastern Ukraine. And there's so much more information to go over here. I had interrupted you to go back over, follow up a couple of questions about the pictures and the location of the Ukrainian military's surface-to-air missiles. But when I did interrupt you, you were saying, secondly, I don't know if you remember what your next point
right.
was going to
well,
be in the boat.
No worries. I do remember. It was basically the pictures, the YouTube videos that were quoted. And this is amazing that, you know, back in the times of the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis, you had Adlai Stevenson, who for all of his failings was a gentleman. And you had Nikita Khrushchev, who for all of his failings had decency. And you had that exchange. And the Russians said, okay, yes, you caught us, you know, we had these missiles there. And they, you know, they made a deal to exchange the missiles in Cuba for the missiles in Turkey, which is the part that most U.S. public doesn't know about. And the nuclear war was avoided. And now we have people who have just repeatedly lied, who have repeatedly used accusations of, you know, weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And the same media that told you about the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq are telling you, we're telling you about the gas attacks in Syria. We're telling you about, you know, atrocities in Bosnia. We're telling you about genocide in Kosovo. We're telling you about, you know, how the Russians are to blame for this. I mean, when are people going to wake up and realize that people who've lied to them repeatedly are not to be trusted?
I don't know. I just don't know. Yeah.
Okay, so let's assume for a second that, you know, social media is a reliable source of evidence. You've got this, you know, alleged radio intercept, and let's backtrack here for a second. There's been intercepts of Ukrainian officials' conversations, and even Victoria Nuland and Ambassador Piat talking about who they're going to put in charge in Ukraine in January before the coup happened in late February. And all of these things are, oh, well, these are suspect YouTube videos, and we don't really know who did that, and we refuse to authenticate them. And all of a sudden, you know, the Ukrainians put out a random video, and all of a sudden that's firm evidence. Well, some people actually took a look at the video and said, wait a minute, I know this billboard. And they tracked down the billboard, and the billboard is in the city of Krasnoarmeysk, which is deeply in territory held by the Ukrainian military. So essentially, this video isn't showing a rebel missile being shuttled off, you know, hidden back in Russia. This video is showing the Ukrainians moving one of their launchers with a rocket missing from it deeply in their own territory and falsely presenting it as something else. Now, why would they be doing that? Well, to ask is to answer the question. Furthermore, there was the audio intercept that they claimed proving that the rebels had shot the plane was actually spliced together from several recordings, and the rebels had actually shot down a Ukrainian plane the day before and several other planes in the surrounding days, but they doctored it so as to sound as if they had shot down the civilian airliner. And people did voice analysis, people did the timestamp analysis. I mean, the basic first look at the thing noticed that the video was posted, you know, like 6 or 8 hours before the plane was even to fly over the area, much less be shot down. But the most damning piece of evidence, I think actual evidence, is that the plane was nowhere its supposed flight path. This is the 21st century. All of this data is online. You had data for planes that were flying the same route days before, weeks before, and they all went like 200 miles further south. And for some reason, this particular flight is routed by the air traffic control, the Ukrainian air traffic control, north across the war zone.
Well, no,
I'm not gonna get into the Russian evidence that there was a Ukrainian military plane nearby, and there's theories whether, you know, the plane was hit with an air missile, and after it didn't blow up from that, was shot down by the ground to air missile just to make sure that it was destroyed. I haven't looked into this. I don't know, but the fact that the plane was rerouted, and the first excuse was, oh, it was bad weather. There was no bad weather. There's proof that there was no bad weather.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you, right. They said at first was, well, they had to reroute them around a storm.
Right. There was no storm. There was no bad weather. All the data from the air traffic control was seized and sealed. None of it is being made public. The tweets that the Spanish national posted were deleted. He disappeared. I mean, this is one of those massive cover-up indications of, you know, there's too many things wrong for the official story to hold water. Simply too many things wrong. And the worst of this is, it was a tragedy that 300 people died. I will say this, and I will absolutely underline it, that it's absolutely unconscionable that these poor people got killed. They were innocents, just like the people on the ground trying to live their lives and being bombed by the government that purports to be their own. But if these people were actually shot down as a false flag attack to blame Russia and cause war, then this crime is like trifold in magnitude. I mean, this is, we're talking not squared, not crime squared, but crime cubed.
Yeah. Well, and like you said, you know, just with the rapidity that we go through these kinds of things in this era, people ought to be wise to this now. If not outright, you know, false flag attacks and setups from your local FBI sting operation, you know, all the way up to the largest cases, at least look at Iraq weapons of mass destruction. Look at, you know, John Kerry's claims about all of the facts about gas attack in Syria last summer, this kind of thing, that at least you can't tell them to tell you the truth, even if they aren't the ones who are really behind whatever horrible thing happened. They still aren't telling you the truth about it, ever.
Exactly. And that's part of the problem. But even that would be somewhat forgivable, at least, because, okay, we expect governments to lie. But when the representative of that very same government, Kerry's spokesperson, comes up to the podium and tells reporters, you know, we tell nothing but the truth and the Russians constantly lie, I mean, that takes – I don't even know what character trait that takes. You know, it's just mind-blowing arrogance and complete disrespect for the truth that gets me.
Yeah, well, you know what it is too, is the reporters love that because they get to be on Team Righteous against the bad guys. So, you know, like Dan Rather – put it most blatantly kind of after September 11th, but it really goes for all these guys all the time. And that is, hey, ultimately, I'm lining up behind my commander in chief and saluting, and you tell me what to do and say. I'm on, you know, I may be a reporter, but I'm on team U.S. government first, you know?
Well, and okay, well, and again, you know, that's, if they admit to it publicly, that's fair enough. We know where we stand with them.
Right.
But at the same time, they're like, oh, no, we're honest and objective and love the truth, and these evil Russians keep lying in their propaganda. And how does that square? I mean, so far, and full disclosure, I'm on RT like twice a week. They talk to me regularly. They haven't paid me a penny. This is all volunteer work. For you know, they call me to comment on stuff, and I do. Because they listen to me and they don't censor me, and you know they never serve me loaded questions, unlike the Western media that have tried over the years. So I don't, but I don't work for them by any stretch of imagination. And they're accused of being propaganda, and I keep thinking, no. I mean, I've seen propaganda at work. They're not propaganda. This is not how you do propaganda. They bend over backwards to be objective and fair, even you know using the language and concepts that are anti-Russian served by the Western media because, again, they're trying to be fair even when it's to their detriment.
Well, I'll disagree with you a little bit about that. I think they're perfectly happy to make America look bad in any and all cases that they can possibly come up with, but I'm not blaming them. I'm blaming America for the U.S. government, particularly for being horrible on so many freaking things. They do nothing but just hand... They don't have to lie. RT doesn't have to propagandize. All they got to do is report the facts about the predator state of the U.S. government all day long, and they make our society look horrible. You know?
Well, I mean, it's one
just
of those
true.
If you don't
want to
sucks, yeah, be called out for hypocrisy, first step is don't be a hypocrite.
Yeah, ask the pile of skulls in Iraq. They'll tell you, you know, America really sucks. Now, the U.S. government, I try to differentiate. Now, I'm sorry, because I've helped to derail. It's my fault. I've derailed this entire conversation. But when we get back with Nebojša Malac after the top of the hour, we'll be talking more about the situation in Ukraine and even the risk of war with Russia, which I think is real. Because Ray McGovern and Eric Margolis say so, too, and I listen to them. Hey, this part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Coming up on the show, Jonathan Landay is going to be back to talk about the Islamic State, what Obama know and Wendy know it, and all that interesting stuff. Right now, we're on the line with Nebojša Malić from antiwar.com, and we're talking about the Ukraine plane, and I really want to talk about the broader war and the history and the this and the that and the whatever you think people really ought to be told here, Nebojša, but if we can wrap up on the plane here real quick, I wanted to point out that the Associated Press and, in fact, Landay at McClatchy Newspapers and many others reported that they had kind of a pool briefing by high-level, all-anonymous intelligence officials climbing down rapidly from virtually every crazy accusation that John Kerry and Samantha Power had said. And then no sooner did that come out than Reuters had come out with this story saying, huh, here's a rebel leader admitting that, yeah, they did have that kind of rocket, and yeah, they must have tried to cover up the shoot down by sending it back to Russia. And that's where I wanted to ask you, I guess, Nebojša, whether you've seen this and recommend to the audience Moon of Alabama, which is a great blog that doesn't, they don't believe anything that they're told by the government, and it turns out they're always right. Ukraine, Reuters interviews Benedict Arnold, rebels had book, however you say it, downed MH17. And this is about how the guy that they interviewed, the big Reuters scoop, Khodorkovsky, Alexander Khodorkovsky, apparently is not a rebel, is a former rebel who has decided to side back with Kiev again, and yet was put forward as basically being a spokesman for the guilty parties here on the at least so-called rebel side. I guess that's a pretty apt term for them. Nebojša, did you have a comment about all of that?
I did hear about the story, and it gets even better. Apparently, several other blogs, including Vineyard of the Saker, have actually taken apart the BBC coverage and Reuters coverage of this interview and concluded that the interview was doctored because Khodorkovsky never actually said this.
Oh, right. He's even, in fact, denying part of it, right?
Right. So he said, we may have had it, I don't know. And what they aired was, we had it, and I know. And so it's one of those things of, I mean, I hate to bring up.
Did they air it or did they just write it? Did they actually doctor an audio clip of that?
I don't know. I think it was a translation thing, so they may have overdubbed him.
Right.
But you know, it's very difficult to how do you notice if you
that
don't
could have been an accident and confirmation bias too, but maybe not. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I don't know whether they did this deliberately or not. I'm just saying that, you know, there's evidence that this was doctored to fit the narrative.
Right, yeah.
And so, you know, even when this guy can't corroborate their crazy claims, you've got the situation in which, you know, you've got the government and the media in the Anglosphere trying their best and hardest to blame Russia and the rebels for this, and their case simply doesn't hold water. And that's the, you know, that's the worst part of this whole story, that, you know, if you start thinking about it, if it was the Ukrainians who shot down the plane in order to make it a false flag and garner condemnation of Russia, and actually the U.S. officials immediately said, oh, this is going to be a game changer, this is going to persuade Europeans to follow with our sanctions, because that's the broader war that you wanted to comment about. The broader context of this is that what's happening on the ground in eastern Ukraine or Nova Russia, whichever way you want to look at it, is actually just one of the fronts. It's one of the trees in this particular forest. The big struggle, the big picture, the strategic fight is between Russia and the United States over Europe, because the United States is trying to force the Europeans to sever their economic and political ties with Russia, which would hurt the European economy tremendously. It wouldn't really hurt the American economy because the United States doesn't have that much of a trade exchange with Russia, which is abominable for a country that styles itself to be a good neighbor. But the Europeans have all, you know, they import energy, they import all sorts of raw materials, they even import technology and weapons, and it goes both ways. And so the whole thing is, okay, let's sever Russia and Europe so Europeans can stay our good clients and we can, you know, we can control the rest of the world. What the Russians on the other hand are saying, look, you know, we've got all this great economic exchange and there's no reason we should be enemies. We should work together. And if the Americans want to join us, great. And if they don't want to join us, we can do without them. We don't really want to fight anybody, but you know, we've got these Nazis killing our people here, and you know, who among you would do otherwise? And so this is really about what the Europeans are going to decide. And based on what I've seen so far, you know, the French are extremely reluctant to break their contracts with Russia. The Germans realize that breaking contracts with Russia and breaking ties with Russia would be economic suicide for them. So I think if the airplane was shot down for the sake of convincing the Europeans to be hostile to Russia, then we're dealing with 300 people murdered over policy. And that is just a crime.
Yeah, the whole thing's madness. And you know, it's funny because the American position, even on the climb down, is Russia has created this entire atmosphere that this happened by supporting the rebels, even in spirit. Or, you know, whatever
well, okay.
it is.
If we're going to talk about atmosphere and conditions, let's just be frank and blunt here. The atmosphere and the conditions that created this entire war were midwived, in her own words, by Victoria Nuland in February when her people, the person that she named in the phone conversation, took over the government with the help of the Nazis and overthrew a legitimately elected government, which may have been bad, but it was legal.
And again,
was acting with remarkable restraint towards people who violently tried to overthrow it and eventually did. And then they started a war against their own population, claiming that these were terrorists. So if anybody created conditions for anything, it's the United States government performing a coup in Ukraine.
Sure. Yeah, I was. I'm sorry for interrupting there. I was just going to clarify Victoria Nuland being the U.S. ambassador to the European Union, basically Assistant Secretary of State for Europe, or.
She gets to make the policy for Europe and Eurasia, and considering sure. that she's been Dick Cheney's assistant, Strobe Talbot's chief of staff, ambassador to NATO, and the wife of Robert Kagan,
yeah.
do we really want somebody like that to make our policy and then, you know, John Kerry and Obama having to either follow or get out of the way? I mean, I don't
right.
know to which extent they're even in charge.
Yeah, well, I mean, the combination of the two of them gave her the job. I don't know under what pressure, but... Or whether they just thought it would be a great idea or what. I mean, it's their responsibility either way.
Agreed.
But yeah. I mean, the thing is, Ron Paul was saying, just like you said, hey, as long as we're talking atmosphere, really, you could go back to February and the American back coup. And then everybody said, what a kook. Ron Paul is saying that the atmosphere is what counts here rather than what really happened. And it's like, no, he was actually just responding to what you guys were saying, that that's all you have left is that the atmosphere was created by the Russians. But then they go, oh, what a hollow argument when you turn it around. God dang
well,
it.
Well, that's exactly the point. I mean, we're dealing with people who have a philosophy, if I may call it that generously, that they can do no wrong and that their enemies, whoever they may be at the moment, can do no right. So if they do something, that's perfectly okay and fine and even virtuous. But if somebody else does something either in self-defense or, you know, a perfectly normal, non-objectionable thing, let alone something objectionable, that's the crime of the highest order and it's unforgivable. We're dealing with people who are absolutely incapable of judging actions on the merit of the actions, but judge actions on the merit of the perpetrator. And you can't win an argument with them because simply, you know, they're always the good guys in their own minds.
Right. They'll just change the subject to the next talking point or whatever it is. I don't care. That's the great part of being a warmonger is you get to be completely shameless and just keep plowing on with whatever kind of lie. They're great at that stuff.
Well, as I like to say, you know, Kagans you can deny reality. Right. You can deny reality all you want. You can deny that there's a wall that you're headed to until you hit the wall. And sooner or later, you know, their denial of reality is going to catch up with them.
Yeah. And the rest of us, too. And in this case, they're messing around with the other biggest pile of H-bombs in the world.
Exactly, and that's why it's a danger to everybody.
Yep. All right, well, thanks very much for your time. It's great to talk to you again, Nebojsa.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
See ya. Nebojsa Malik, everybody, he's at antiwar.com and at the Gray Falcon blog.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today. Corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at scotthorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
Who in the world is going to do my show about Gaza today? Somebody! Look at this. Wait, I got to figure out who this is before I go quoting him, but BBC Sydney correspondent. BBC correspondent reports, ready? Israeli police, Mickey Rosenfeld, tells me men who killed three Israeli teens definitely lone cell. Hamas affiliated, but not operating under their leadership. And that's actually one of two. Let's find the other part of that quote. Seems to contradict the line from Netanyahu government. Yeah, it does. Israeli police spokesman Mickey Rosenfeld also said, if kidnapping had been ordered by Hamas leadership, they'd have known about it in advance. Oh, really? Oh, my God. You know, yeah, I got to change the subject back for just one second. Me and Nebojsa are just joking in the Skype chat there about how, I'm sorry, I says to him, I meant to ask you about what's going on in the Ukrainian parliament. And he said, oh, you know what? I'm glad you didn't because I don't quite have a complete handle on it to comment yet. And I said, okay, well, go look at Jason Ditz. He's got a great write-up of it. Looks like they're trying to purge the communists. And he laughs, you know, ha-ha, internet type laughing. Normally, I would support such a thing. But when it's the Nazis doing the purging, oh no! I don't know. I mean, really, if it comes down to outright communism, they'll starve you to death worse than the Nazis will. Unless the Nazis hate you, in which they might just draw and quarter you and your whole family, so... Yeah, I don't know how you choose between Nazis and commies. This has been the struggle in Ukraine for 100 years almost. Poor guys. I mean, really, you think about how bad we've got it here in our crappy, bankrupt, three-quarter fascist liberal democracy between our liberals and conservatives. What if we really, like, not just in hyperbole kind of accusation sort of way, but really... Our parties were the Nazis and the commies, and this was who was doing all the fighting all the time. Holy crap. What a crappy way to run a society. And no, I know the Nazis did not win a large percentage in the elections, but so they run the National Guard, and they're killing people. They have power. They did the coup. And they've won their spoils for it. I don't see any massive concerted effort whatsoever, do you, on the part of the American government or the Europeans to get everybody who's not a Nazi in the Kiev coalition to purge the actual Nazis out of there? What are they, afraid of Svoboda and Right Sector? They have to give them 8 major positions in their government? Nazis purging commies, and we gotta go, oh no, the commies are getting thrown out of the pro. I can't go that far. But I can't quite complain about it. But Anyway, yeah, it's just, as he puts it, it's just a crazy world we live in. You don't have to take sides. You just have to recognize how insane this is. That you could even entertain for a moment that you might have to side with the commies versus the Nazis or the other way around? I don't know, man. I can't, again, which is worse? Look at Mao and Stalin. They killed more people than Hitler. Although he does seem to have been meaner, you know? Anyway, what a crazy world we live in here where we've known all along everybody who is not a pro-Israel ideologue and therefore, you know, ultimately dishonest knew that Benjamin Netanyahu was just bluffing and blowing smoke, blaming it on Hamas. Everybody knew that was a lie. You could tell it was a lie just when he said it and the way he said it. If it had been true, it wouldn't have come out the way it did. He wouldn't have said it the way he said it. It was just too obviously fake. Hamas like, what? We didn't kidnap the three kids. Why would we do that? We're right in the middle. They had just signed on to a coalition government, which, what does that mean? Does that mean that the Fatah government in the West Bank had just signed on to every bit of Hamas's program? No, it means exactly the opposite. It means that they had just signed on completely to the framework for the Palestinians' position on achieving a state and recognizing Israel. A point that I left out of my Prager refutation, which, because, I mean, his thing was out of date. It wasn't current. But that was something that I was criticized, or that was mentioned in that criticism of me in the YouTube comment, that I didn't cover that, but I didn't get that far. I didn't have that much time. But anyway, what a crazy world we live in. Here they admit it. Max Blumenthal reported on this show 2 weeks ago that the two guys that did it, well, it was one of their backyards is where they ended up, quote unquote, finding the bodies 2 weeks later when they already knew who these guys were and knew that they were not loyal to Hamas. They're a rival breakoff group and this and that crap. Anyway, Israel shells UN school in Gaza, killing 16 civilians, wounding hundreds. And then they tried to pretend for a minute that they didn't do it, and then they admitted that they did it. Oh, yeah, no, it must have been a Hamas rocket. And you know what? Richard Engel from NBC News was like, that's funny. It would have Hamas missed 5 rockets and accidentally bombed the UN school where the people are being sheltered, right? I guess that is explanation number 4 on the list or something. False flag attack, possibly something. No. No. The Israelis admitted it and bragged about it on their Twitter feed that they had attacked the school. You can read the whole write-up at mondoweiss.org right now. Here it is at antiwar.com as well. Israel shells UN school in Gaza, killing 16 civilians, wounding hundreds, telling filthy lies. For just a little while, just long enough for right-wingers to memorize them and repeat them and solidify that, oh, even when Israel attacks a school where families are hiding out from the IDF's rampage, it's still the victim's fault, always. Give me a talking point. I don't care if it's true. Give me a talking point, the American right cries in unison. Tell me any lie. I'll believe it and repeat it for Israel. Oh, we accidentally bombed a UN school full of cowering, hiding, pathetic, defenseless refugees. Children. Oh, yeah, no, but they were storing, the UN was storing a bunch of rockets for Hamas there. Shut up. Everybody knows you're lying. Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman, never afraid to make a bad situation worse, not only insisted that Hamas was operating near the schools, which is the military's claim, but claimed the UN was storing rockets for Hamas in the schools openly. Oh, openly, too. Israel has been demanding hundreds of thousands of Gaza civilians leave their soon-to-be-leveled homes, but are not letting them leave the Gaza Strip and are attacking literally every town there, so there is literally no place for the refugees to go. They're also attacking and killing five so far, I believe, on the West Bank. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all the stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state. Available at ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm him. Next up is Jonathan S. Landay from McClatchy Newspapers. That's McClatchyDC.com. The latest is Obama administration knew Islamic State was growing, but did little to counter it. Welcome back to the show, Jonathan. How are you doing?
Good to be here, as usual.
Good, good. Very happy to have you here. All right, so it's a very complicated, very thoroughly reported story here, and we only have one short 10-minute segment, so go right ahead, sir, and explain, please.
So what I did was go back and look at what's everything that's kind of in the open about what the United States knew about what's now known, or what now calls itself the Islamic State, previously the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, previously Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And I discovered that there was a great deal that, in fact, in open testimony, both U.S. diplomats and U.S. intelligence officials basically have said that the United States has been closely tracking this group, at least since 2012, that it was watching this group as it enlarged its operations from Iraq to Syria, watched as this group seized the oil-rich province of Raqqa, was getting this massive influx of thousands of foreign fighters who were coming into Syria from Turkey, and were also well aware that it was using this area in Syria as a springboard from which it began sending men and material back into Iraq with plans to seize the so-called emirate that they have. And yet, they also knew that the government, the Iraqi government of Nouri al-Maliki, was unable to handle this problem, and yet continued to follow a policy which was essentially, Maliki has to deal with this, but we'll help him do it.
Mm-hmm. And as you say, this whole thing was complicated by the Syria policy, where America was continually condemning Maliki for letting Iran ship supplies to Assad for his exact same fight that Maliki had on his hands.
Well, that's right. That one of the things that they were saying to Maliki was, you want our help? You're going to have to do something about the fact that you're allowing Iran to fly through your airspace with weapons bound for Assad.
Which is absolutely crazy. And this is where you get into in the article, the one alternative policy has been proposed over the past 3 years is America should really support the so-called moderate rebels in Syria to a strong enough degree that they can overthrow Assad and resist the jihadis. But it seems like if your priority is the jihadis, I'm not saying we should pay Assad to torture and kill these guys the way George W. Bush did, but at least it doesn't seem to make sense at all to pick anyone on the Sunni jihadi's side against the secular Alawite dictatorship in Damascus, Jonathan.
Well, in fact, that's exactly what happened. They really didn't pick anyone. Yes, they picked a group, a sort of quote-unquote moderate group, mostly run mostly by Iraqis who had lived outside of Iraq for decades, some of whom are associated with the Muslim Brotherhood. But it didn't give them anything but non-lethal assistance and political assistance. Every time they looked at the groups who were actually fighting on the ground, apparently they saw jihadi connections, or if not outright, Al-Qaeda connections, or Al-Qaeda being these, or that this, or groups were Al-Qaeda affiliates. And so that kind of tied them up in knots. And quite frankly, you know, they had a point, and the point being that there were no so-called moderate groups who were capable of doing the kind of fighting that the jihadis were doing, are doing. And that's why, you only recently saw the administration, I think 3 days before the declaration of the so-called caliphate, come out and say, okay, we've decided we're going to spend $500 million on arming and training vetted moderate groups. That proposal seems not to have gone anywhere either, at least at this point, because those groups really don't seem to exist.
Mm-hmm.
Not
right,
any,
now,
not with any strength, anyway.
Now, I'm sorry to suggest a coherence to this policy at all, and I don't mean to say it in the most kind of like conspiracy theory sort of sounding terms or anything, but I just wonder if in context this actually makes sense. Like Hirsch reported in 07 or 08 about the redirection, that they realized that going along with Chalabi and fighting a war for Iran in Iraq, basically, for the Shia, was their gigantic strategic mistake, and now it was time to redirect back toward the Saudis and the Sunnis. And as Michael Oren recently put it, Israel certainly prefers the Sunni jihadists to Hezbollah or Syria because they're backed by Iran, and that's the ultimate evil in the whole wide world. And so maybe this is a policy of just America and Saudi deliberately backing the Mujahideen. Not that they control them all, but this is, they're doing this all on purpose rather than they're just the dumbest foreign policy people ever.
I'm not quite sure that's correct, Scott, because what they knew, what they've known for a very long time, is that the Islamic State has had its sights set on American targets. And so what
that's
you essentially
insane.
Do is you're suggesting that they were helping a jihadi group that eventually intends to attack American targets?
Well,
I mean, that's where this, that's why, where this whole whole approach falls down. Because, yes, you're tied in knots over the idea that if we back the Islamists, that means we're backing al-Qaeda, and if we don't, we're helping the Syrians. But it, what it doesn't track with is the fact that in being tied up in knots, you're allowing a threat, a terrorist threat, against American targets to proliferate.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't mean to say that that's their point or whatever, but they could be criminally negligent in that sense. If you look at Hirsch's report back then, it was that they're supporting Fatah al-Islam, which was an al-Qaeda-ite group in Lebanon, and that they were talking with the Muslim Brotherhood and some other Sunni jihadi-type dissidents inside Syria, and they were working with Jandala in Iran, and they were turning back toward the Saudis, and the Mujahideen are a useful tool when they're not attacking us, right?
Well, in theory, but, you know, I think in the end, as I write in the story, a lot of people believe that they just kind of got tied up in knots and ended up sort of leaving this void into which the Saudis stepped. And they kind of turned a blind eye to that for a while. But don't forget, President Obama went to Saudi Arabia earlier this year, and following that, you saw the Saudis dismiss their intelligence chief and a lot of his people, mm-hmm. because those were the guys who believed in supporting some of these jihadi groups.
Yeah, it seemed like maybe they
really
called
track.
Off this project last summer when, or last spring when ISIS split from Nusra. No?
Sorry?
It seemed to me like they maybe changed the policy back last spring and summer when ISIS split from Nusra, and that seemed to be the time that Bandar got canned.
It could very well
like
be.
Like it got way out of control at that point, you know?
Right, but the fact is that the Americans were watching it get way out of control since 2012.
Right. Which
and
is actually, I have the clip of Hillary saying this is why not to intervene back in the spring of 2012, saying
Zawahiri's
endorsed this thing.
Yeah, but the same year, don't forget, a little later on, you had Hillary supporting the arming, along with Leon Panetta and the former head of the CIA, David Petraeus, in trying to build moderate rebel groups in Syria.
Right.
So you had this, the incoherence seems to, and the paralysis seems to be above their levels, and that would put it in the White House.
Right. Yeah, a little bit of them believing their own talking points, like when Kerry testified before McCain, he got caught up and just sort of said out loud what he would have liked us to believe, that, oh yeah, most of the rebels are, you know, secular moderates, and the whole place kind of laughed. That was what they would have liked us to believe, but
exactly.
He had almost convinced
they,
himself that, it sounded like.
But that's what they wanted to believe themselves, absolutely, because
yeah.
That would have made policy a little easier.
Yeah, because even the Northern Storm Brigade that McCain was palling around with over there, they told Time Magazine on video, yeah, we're veterans of the Iraq War, where they fought against our guys.
We, that's right. We fought in Fallujah.
Yeah.
I mean, but that's the point. And so, but here's the other point. If you've run for president, right? Uh-huh. It's about accepting leadership and accepting, but basically telling you, I can deal with these hard problems. And that's not what's happened here. Or at least it was dealt in a way that didn't deal with it. And meanwhile, the United States intelligence community and the diplomats are watching the growth of a group that is that has declared openly its intention to attack Americans.
Right. Well, and you know, I've been speaking weekly with Mitchell Prothero, your colleague, reporting from Irbil there, and he certainly seems to think this seems to be the consensus. Patrick Coburn, Eric Margolies, and everyone that. You know, they're surrounded by enemies, but none of whom are really capable of fielding an army against them. So they really kind of, they have their state. They're making it.
Oh, more than
In
that.
In fact, you and I had this conversation two or three weeks before they sacked Mosul.
I mean, they are on a tear, not just in Iraq, but in Syria as well now. They have been on an offensive where they have now secured basically all of oil and gas-rich Raqqa province. They are pursuing an offensive next door in Haraska. They are also on a tear in Deir ez-Zor, and the regime is unable to handle them. They have been some of the fiercest fighting of the 3 years in Syria within the last several weeks, and given what's going on the other side of the border, where you've had the Iraqi army unable to deal with these people as well, raises in my mind the question of how long will Iran, which don't forget is, you know, the chief supporter of both of these governments, how long will Iran, a regional supporter, how long will Iran allow this to continue before it gets even more involved than it already is?
Right. All right, and we'll leave it there because I know you got to go, but thank you so much for your time, Jonathan. Appreciate
Always
it.
A pleasure.
Great stuff here. That's Jonathan Landay, everybody, McClatchyDC.com. And the headline is Obama Administration Knew Islamic State Was Growing But Did Little to Counter It. We'll be right back. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. All right, that was Jonathan Landay. I kept him a little bit into the commercial break segment recording there. You'll be able to hear the end of it in the archives later on at scotthorton.org/interviews. I'm not good with the breaks, and he's not good with breaks either, so what the hell. I went ahead and turned the music down here in the studio and kept talking with him here. You know, I don't know. I wonder if there's a briefing where they told him, Mr. President, they're ready for a full-scale invasion of northwestern Iraq. They're headed toward Mosul. Do you want us to carpet bomb them in the desert? And did he say no? Or how did that go down? What happened there? I would be for that. If I was the president, I would say do not bomb them because you're not going to obliterate them by doing that. It might feel really good to carpet bomb a convoy full of bin Ladenites, you know, declare bin Ladenites in black masks or whatever. Go ahead and obliterate them. But then what? All you're doing is turning their local war, making sure that you're turning their local war toward you. You know, he says in here there are dozens. Landay says there's so much in here. I should have just shut up and let him talk more. I don't know. I'm trying to get to the bottom of why. Maybe help him get to the bottom of why or something. I don't know. But yeah, he does say in here that there are dozens of Americans who've gone there to fight. I've been paranoid about this for a long time. I'm not trying to give any stupid idiots any bad ideas. But I think, you know, come on, we got to be honest about this, that if some wannabe jihadi idiot is willing to go to Syria to fight to join up with these guys, then he might just save the effort and stay home and still fight on their side, right? this could be a problem. And I'm not trying to justify the war. I'm trying to say that's exactly why to gotta knock this off, man. Absolutely have to stop intervening over there right now. You know, we can do like David Stockman and do the chain of dominoes all the way back to Woodrow Wilson. But even just look at the terror war and the Iraq war spreading to Libya and to Syria, back into Iraq, spreading from Libya into Mali and into Nigeria. Well, should we invade Nigeria? Hey, look, there's a Muslim, an extremist Sunni Muslim with a rifle. As far south and west as Nigeria. So maybe we should invade Nigeria, invade northern Mali, which is the size of Texas. If you've never been to Texas, it's really big. Invade Libya. Invade the Sinai Peninsula. Invade, hell, Jordan and Palestine. Invade everywhere that Al-Qaeda sends their flag. That's exactly what bin Laden, you know, you kind of got to be a slightly grateful that he explained exactly what he was doing. He goes, hey, Americans, all I have to do is send my men with a flag upon which it is written Al-Qaeda. That was the translation anyway. To the furthest point east, he could have said west. And that'll be enough to get you to send all your generals racing and all your billions of dollars wasted to fight your war. And they can raise that flag any old where. And according to our government establishment, anytime this happens, we gotta fight them. But the only reason that they exist in this kind of numbers anyway is because we've been fighting them all this time. We've been fighting them over there, so we don't have to fight them over here, except they only ever were fighting us because we were over there in the first place. And ever since we started really fighting them over there with the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq, they've just done nothing but multiply all across the Middle East. And man, Barack Obama, you know what? Here's the thing. I agree with Landay that they're tied in a knot, and it is stupidity, kind of, in a way. You have these competing interests, like Israel really wants us to hate Syria, and it's really important that we do for our local political reasons and these kinds of things. And, geez, on the other hand, we kind of have a strategic interest in fighting against the Mujahideen, since they're the ones that are our actual enemies. And so these shots are called, you know? Here's that clip of Hillary Clinton. I forget if this was during the break or not that Landay and I discussed it. But here's that clip of Hillary Clinton from June. No, it was March. So spring of 2012, 2 years ago, a little more than 2 years ago, talking about, she's actually being criticized. Because again, the talking point is, why isn't America doing enough to overthrow Bashar al-Assad? Why aren't we doing, nobody wants a land invasion, but why aren't we doing enough to back the rebels, Hillary Clinton? That was the only talking point. Not, hey, these rebels are some pretty scary guys, huh? But that was her excuse, see?
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria? Hamas is now supporting the opposition. Are we supporting Hamas in Syria? So I think, Wyatt, you know, despite the great pleas that we hear from those people who are being ruthlessly assaulted by Assad, if you're a military planner or if you're a secretary of state and you're trying to figure out, do you have the elements of an opposition that is actually viable, we don't see that.
There you go. And that was, as Landay pointed out in response when I cited that, he said, yeah, and then 6 months later, it was her, Panetta, and Petraeus who were pushing to do exactly this. And then, you know what, here's this one too, man. This is from 2012 as well. 2012, Sanger, jihadists, Syria. You may know Sanger from Iran nuclear propaganda fame in the New York Times, if you keep track of these things. Jihadists receiving most arms sent to Syrian rebels, reports New York Times. Slightly, its word is slightly different. Actually, when you click on it, it's rebel arms flow is said to benefit jihadists in Syria, okay? Arms flow Syria, New York Times. Arms flow jihadists. These are your footnotes. And what it says here is, of course, America doesn't want to exactly like arm up the very worst bin Ladenites, but they sure would like to undermine Assad. And geez, it just seems to keep happening that all the money and weapons that we send to the rebels end up in the hands of, sorry, I know, I've been repeating myself like this for 3 years straight. Those willing to fight with the weapons. That's right. That's who ends up with the weapons. Those willing to use them. Are the moderates the ones out there fighting and dying for their moderate way of life? Not so much. And I didn't have time because Lande was in a real time crunch thing, man. But we could have talked about how, I believe it was Lande himself was reporting, certainly McClatchy News was reporting, that the U.S. government, not just Hillary Clinton, but, you know, the intelligence community and what have you, as early as 2011, were saying that, hey, listen, this, again, was their excuse for not doing more for Israel's anti-Assad policy, right? And it was, listen, I mean, the al-Nusra Front is basically al-Qaeda in Iraq. They're this, predominantly the Syrian veterans of al-Qaeda in Iraq. So, then ISIS, they're what? Even worse. They're the Iraqi and the primarily the rest of the foreigners split off from Nusra with ISIS. They're the everybody else guys and no longer loyal to Zawahiri. Because Zawahiri told them to stay loyal to Nusra after it was already too late for that, because he's a stupid idiot apparently and completely blew up all of his own presumed authority over these men who are thousands of miles from him. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi said, you know, for all your jihad, what do you have to show for it? I declare an Islamic state and there's nobody to stop me. And he was right. That's the fruition of it. But anyway, they split off from Nusra. But even before then, the American government was saying that was, again, as their excuse for not intervening more on the side of the rebels, that these guys really are, from the very beginning, from 2011 on, these guys really are al-Qaeda in Iraq. That's who they are. They got a new lease on life, the rebellion in Syria. And it's just like George Bush's democracy project. Remember, George Bush came into the Middle East where you have nothing but dictatorships, all of them. And then there were three dictatorships in the Middle East that were no longer sock puppets of the United States. Well, I don't know if Syria was ever really a sock puppet state of America. But Iraq and Iran and Syria, the three countries who are not the sock puppets of the United States, somehow the democracy agenda only applies to them. Same kind of thing with the Obamaites' response to the Arab Spring. We support revolution in all the states Israel wants overthrown the most. In Yemen, in Saudi Arabia, in Bahrain, yeah, not so much. Kuwait, forget it. Iraq, get shot. But Syria, yeah. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. All right, y'all. That's funny. The Israelis reject ceasefire deal is the headline on CNN. Seems like they would have waited for Hamas to reject it since it's completely ridiculous, as reported here in Haaretz. During this ceasefire, Israel and Hamas will begin negotiations. Oh, whoops, I skipped number one, didn't I? A one-week temporary ceasefire starting Sunday, during which Israel Defense Force troops will not leave the Gaza Strip entirely and will continue to locate and destroy Hamas tunnels. So, in other words, during the ceasefire, the Israelis will not have to cease fire. But then CNN right now, Blitzer and them are talking about, well, the Israelis went ahead and rejected the American Egyptian deal anyway. I know what you're asking. Why don't the people of Gaza just flee? And the answer is because on one side they have the ocean, where even if they try to swim for it, they'll get shot. And to the south, they have the American-backed fascist military dictatorship of Field Marshal al-Sisi, who has them hemmed in with might as well be an impenetrable force field, basically. And in the east and in the north, the only way out is toward Israel. Well, yeah, you better stay out of that border region. You better not even head toward it, because you won't get to it, because Israeli snipers will kill you. And so there you go. That's north, east, southwest. Their airport was exploded. They have no seaport. They have no passports. They're trapped. They're prisoners in a canned hunt. That's why they don't run away. There's nowhere to run away to. The Israeli government keeps saying, hey, what the hell are you doing out here in the suburbs? Get to the center of the city. It's the only safe place for you. Everybody out of your houses. Everybody to the center of the city. And then they bomb the hell out of the center of the city, too. Bomb UN schools. Bomb hospitals. Oh, they claim somebody fired a harmless firecracker at them from near the hospital. So, by all means, go ahead and hit it with, I don't know, what's the upper limit on acceptable number of artillery shells to fire at a hospital, as long as you're claiming that somebody shot a Roman candle at you from the parking lot next door? It's not even a question of proportion. They're actually just waging a terror campaign against the civilians of Gaza. I've seen tweet after tweet of Gazans saying and being, you know, retweeted by journalists there and other journalists. I think journalists as well tweeting this. Well, I think all the Gazans I'm following are journalists, as far as I know. And they're saying, man, this shelling is at random. I mean, you, as far as I can tell anyway, I don't see any rhyme or reason or targeting going on here. They are just shelling the crap out of this neighborhood. It's what's going on in Gaza right now. And so, you know, the problem is a lot of times what we do is we make assumptions about the goodness of whatever side we pick. And so within those assumptions, these kinds of things don't make sense. So there must be lies. Why in the world would Israel target civilians when they're just trying to get the Hamas rockets? Well, you might ask, you know, take that same exact parallel and apply it to the siege itself. They claim that the purpose of the siege is to prevent Hamas from getting rockets, and yet they admit on the record over and over again that their policy is to keep the population of Gaza hungry, but not starving, on a diet, a lot thinner. It's called collective punishment. It's terrorism. It's the dictionary definition of terrorism. Killing or attacking civilians in order to influence the policy of their government. Especially in a democracy where the government has to stand for election and the will of the people even counts, as Robert Pape has explained it. That's how suicide terrorism seems to always work. And Hamas is democratically elected. The Israelis are too, but, you know, just because the Israelis have a state, that doesn't mean what they do is not terrorism, when what they're doing is terrorism. They're trying to, and they've stated this kind of policy over and over again through their history of attacks on Palestine and in southern Lebanon too, that, and this is the exact same rationalization that the Americans adopt for carrying out a lot of pro-Israel policies like sanctions and bombings and war against Iraq, is that we've got to make the people, and Iran, we have to make the people suffer so bad that they force the government to change their policy. In fact, the American war party refrain on the nuclear talks even happening at all is that, you know, they shouldn't be happening, but also that they're happening because the sanctions worked. They're desperately seeking justification for keeping cancer medicine from the dying, from destroying an economy, causing deaths just by creating complete havoc. It is terrorism. That's what it is. It's a war crime. It's horrible. And it doesn't matter exactly what the law says. You know, the law says the Israelis are breaking the law. They're war criminals. The law says America can do sanctions under the United Nations and this and that and whatever. And it's the same damn thing. I mean, look at, you know, the no-fly zone bombings in the 1990s mostly targeted military targets. You know, all, you know, Iraqi conscripts' lives being forfeit, of course, right? But it was the blockade that starved a million of them to death, that deprived a million of them to death. That's the same kind of thing going on in Gaza, too, you know? They have their blockade, they have their regular bombings, and people call it a genocide, and I go, eh, you know, I'm a real stickler about that term. You don't hear me throwing that term around loosely, because, hey, that means a war to eradicate an entire people off the face of the earth, and we are still talking about under 1,000 dead. It'll soon be more. And that's a lot of individual human beings. But does it amount to a genocide? Yeah, I don't know. Jeez, I don't know. But if you perhaps broaden the definition a little bit to, you know, a nationality of people. Yeah. And they're trying to wipe Palestinian civilization off of the planet. And this has been remarked upon by plenty of Israeli commentators. It's not even controversial. That's what so much of this is about, is just completely undermining any kind of community, any kind of stability, any kind of real, you know, attachment to their past, because they're constantly in a state of just complete occupation and chaos. Sewage in the streets and drones overhead when they're not killing them, terrifying their children out of their minds, and on and on. And anyway, to think that somehow the dominant narrative in America still is poor little Israel is besieged by the Palestinians. Are you kidding me? Where do you people come up with this crap? Let's see. The occupied territories, which are basically a fourth or fifth world nation and not even a nation, some of the lowest standards of living on the planet, they're the ones occupying the military and national police force that are occupying them. The military and national police force of a first world European style power with a full-scale army and air force, and including nuclear weapons, as many as 600 nuclear weapons, according to Daniel Ellsberg, who got that number from Mordecai Vanunu, the whistleblower himself. Although I admit that is higher than most estimates, which tend to peak at the Air Force estimate of 400, I believe. And Ellsberg says also they have H-bombs, of course. And, just to get it straight, Gaza and the West Bank have been all completely conquered and subjugated since 1967. They are the occupied. They couldn't possibly be the aggressors. And again, they admit now that Netanyahu staged this whole thing. Well, I didn't mean to say stage it, but drummed up the whole thing out of a kidnapping that he knew wasn't committed by Hamas. That's what I mean. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Are you sick of the neocons and the Israel lobby pretending as though they've earned some kind of monopoly on foreign policy wisdom in Washington, D.C.? These peanut clowns who've never been right about anything? Well, the Council for the National Interest is pushing back, telling the lobby to go take a hike. The empire's bad enough without the neocons making it all about the interests of a foreign state. Help CNI promote peace. Visit their site at councilforthenationalinterest.org and click donate under About Us at the top of the page. All right, you guys, welcome back. So Shira Frenkel is reporting for BuzzFeed from Israel and or Gaza. I think she's kind of going back and forth a little bit. I don't know. But anyway, here she is in a Twitter conversation with Jeffrey Goldberg. She says, after Israel's top leadership exhaustively blamed Hamas for the kidnap of the three teens, they've now admitted the killers were acting as a, quote, lone cell. And I'm sorry, because I got cut off by the damn commercial. I did not mean to say that I'm accusing the Israelis of kidnapping the teens and orchestrating the entire thing. What I meant was that Netanyahu obviously was lying and knew he was lying and created this crisis out of the excuse of three kidnapped and murdered teenagers, which makes him some kind of horrible person, I think. But anyway, so Jeffrey Goldberg says, oh yeah, but I heard they were Hamas. Is it true that they were Hamas? Isn't it true that they were Hamas guys? Huh? What about that? And she responded, Israeli intel, who are her sources for this, the people making the admission, they say, well, the guys who did the kidnap were Hamas 8 years ago. But it wasn't clear if they still were Hamas at all. Which coincides with all the journalism that had already come out that these guys were way a breakoff group in the West Bank, where Gaza, Hamas is not predominant. And anyway, there you go. They admit it, just like I tells you. Just like Max Blumenthal said on the show now 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago. Man, they exploited it like the Reichstag thing. It's, you know, this is really my best answer to the 9/11 truthers, is that, like, hey, I will concede to you that they might as well have done it, for as badly and as cynically as they lied and exploited it. It's the same thing. You know, there actually is a controversy, and maybe it's settled now. I don't know. I'm not an academic. I'm just some guy, you know? But there has been in the past at least some controversy by pseudo-objective historians as to whether the Nazis really did do the Reichstag fire just to blame it on the communists, or whether, you know, they just took advantage of the situation. Of course, the conclusion of Scherer in The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich is that, yeah, the Nazis did it all right. And I believe some of them have confessed at various times. I'm not familiar with the entire controversy. But anyway, point being, yeah, they might as well have done it. First of all, they're the friggin' Nazis. Why wouldn't they have done it? But secondly, even if the communists did it, it doesn't matter. The point is that Hitler lied and exploited it in order to consolidate power for himself. And that's, you know, to get his political ends done, he was willing to exploit a tragedy. It's the same thing we talked about in the Borsa Malik on the show earlier about the plane in Ukraine, where the Americans said, oh, this is a game changer. This is a game changer. This is the worst freaking thing that happened all week, man. 300 people obliterated in a moment. And all you have to say is it's a game changer. But that's what Rahm Emanuel said. You never let a crisis go to waste. And that's what Condoleezza Rice said. You know, hey, everybody, the Chinese word for crisis is the same as opportunity. That's how politicians are. That's their job, responding to crises. That's their job, making sure that there's always a crisis to solve. A crisis. Yeah, I suck at language, but I'm right about everything, so I make up for my poor vocabulary and sometimes pronunciation and stuttering and incoherence. But so, yeah, same kind of thing. Benjamin Netanyahu said, what? Three boys are kidnapped? Perfect. Give me that megaphone. Hey, everybody, Hamas did it, and now it's time to murder a bunch of children. Yeehaw. Fire rocket, fire rocket, fire rocket. Yes, a rocket. Get him. And in fact, you know, don't let me skip the, you know, all-important middle there. Netanyahu pretended for more than 2 weeks. You would think I'm lying, but the journalism is done. Go and look at it. Max Blumenthal, Electronic Intifada, and JJ Forward. I'm sorry. JJ Goldberg at the Jewish Daily Forward. Okay? J.J. Goldberg at the Jewish Daily Forward. Now, maybe Max Blumenthal isn't a Jewish enough name for you when it's at a website like Electronic Intifada. Fine. J.J. Goldberg at the Forward says, yes, inescapable conclusion. Netanyahu pretended that the boys were still alive for weeks as he sent the Shin Bet and the military to do house sweeps and round up hundreds of people in the Gaza Strip, completely destroy, or not, you know, absolutely bulldoze, although they've started that now. Well, they did bulldoze the houses of the two guilty men of their family. The two men who did it. Their families' houses were destroyed. But meanwhile, I mean, the pictures were on Twitter the whole time. The Palestinians can tweet even on only a 2G network. They can get those pictures out. Israel won't let them have even 3G, you understand. But anyway, they're getting their pictures out of their houses completely ransacked, as though Hamas was hiding in the cabinets in the kitchen and this kind of thing. Just going in house to house, completely destroying people's homes, and arrested 500 people who they knew, again, now they admit they knew, had absolutely nothing to do with the kidnapping of these three boys. So, you know, maybe it would only be some kook who would say, oh, well, you know, Mossad must have hired the guys to who did the kidnapping to do it in order to generate this crisis. Maybe that's an absolutely insane position. Point is, why bother with it? You don't even need to go that far as long as we're just assuming things or whatever. You don't have any actual evidence of that. Forget it. You don't even need it. The point is, Benjamin Netanyahu might as well have kidnapped these boys himself, is how glad he was that they'd been kidnapped, is how cynical he was when he exploited it in order to generate this crisis on the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, and now spread back to the West Bank. There was a massive protest last night, 50,000 people marching, I don't know, from Ramallah to somewhere or something, huge, and then it ended up turning violent because some boys threw some stones, and then, or I don't know who shot first. How about the Israelis shot first, and then some boys threw some stones? I don't know. But anyway, five people were killed now, I think. Let me hit refresh. The West Bank casualties, I think, is now five. And, you know, I don't know if that means that this will simply now be the next full-scale intifada. But the Israelis, again, top news, Israelis refuse the peace deal. They don't even give Hamas. The only peace deal the Israelis will offer is the one that they know is the offer that the Palestinians can't possibly accept. And as horrible, as ridiculous as this peace offer that Kerry put forward was, they were too afraid that the Gazans would take them up on it. And they figured they'd take the PR hit in order to just make sure that, no, this deal's dead in the water right now. The killing continues. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Oh, that should be a little higher there. Yep. All right, this is my show. I'm me. Oh, sorry for all the noise. I know it sounds terrible. So this is my show. Hey, check this out, man. U.S. House of Representatives to President Barack Obama. No troops to Iraq without our okay. Ooh, hope that doesn't count special forces, because they're already there, guys. Washington, Associated Press, the House... Whoa, apple juice. The House overwhelmingly passed a resolution Friday that would bar President Barack Obama from sending forces to Iraq in a sustained combat role without congressional approval. Oh, good. There's your special forces exemption right there. I don't mean oh, good, really. I just mean, yeah. There's your question answered. A bill with greater symbolic than legal effect. Oh, I don't know. If he was to go ahead and reinvade without going back to Congress after a resolution like this had passed either house, I think that might be a bigger deal than the way they turned a blind eye back in the Libya war, for example, and refused to really hold the vote. Well, they confused it for a while, and then when it came to a clean vote, they scheduled it for too late and had to go on vacation. That's how they got away with that. Anyway, the non-binding measure has not been debated in the Senate. Its language opens up several questions related to the Constitution's separation of powers between executive and legislative branches, even if Obama and his top military advisors already have ruled out sending combat troops to help Iraq fight extremist insurgents. Friday's legislation was approved by 370-40 vote. Whoa! After Republican and Democratic lawmakers emphasized the need to reassert what they argued, is this a joke? Wait, what is wig.com? Tell me this in The Onion or some crap here. Quincy Harold Wig. Sounds legitimate. I don't know. Like some local paper website? Let me Google the score on this vote and make sure that this is not some hoax. 370-40? When they already have an authorization to go to war in Iraq outstanding? Holy man, it's real! It's at The Hill, it's at ABC, it's at Reuters. No! Oh my God, dude. Can you believe that? Great! Now I guess it depends what happens. You know, as Lande said, I don't think there's any denying the Islamic State right now, they're on a tear, man. They are piling up successes like the Free State Project, dude. In formerly known as Syria and in formerly known as Iraq. I guess, I'm trying to figure out exactly how we should call, I guess the southern Shiite Arab Iran-aligned Baghdad to Basra portion of Iraq should be called George W. Bushistan. And then the Anbar province and the whole Sunni triangle and the Islamic State, I guess that's bin Ladenistan or just the caliphate. Anyway, Iraq is over. And now the Kurds, I forget whether I approve this to run or not, but somebody wrote an interesting thing for antiwar.com about the Kurds and how, well, they're very landlocked up there. If they really declare independence and break their, autonomous but still within Iraq ties to Baghdad and Basra, that might really be counterproductive. They need that access to the water there, I guess. And they would, their only ally would be Erdogan. Interestingly enough, the government of Turkey is the closest in the region to the Kurds right now, but they don't have any kind of decent relationship, well, according to this guy, with the Iranian government. Or, obviously with the Syrian government, although the Syrian government may not be in a position to do anything about an Iraqi-Kurdish alliance with Syrian Kurds. But then again, these big fake borders have been drawn for a long time. These nations have existed for 100 years in a way. And so there's still a lot of tribal and different divisions between the different factions of Kurds. Just because they're Kurds doesn't mean they're all going to rush immediately to join one state. But so in other words, the guy that wrote this article was saying Kurdish independence is still a real, still a real steep hill to climb. You can see why I screwed that up, right? It was hard. just like the hills where they live. Tough road to hoe for them. But they've already announced that they're going to have their referendum on complete independence from Baghdad, and I can't imagine how that'd fail. Once you announce you're doing that, you're doing it. And they've already locked down Kirkuk. They took advantage of the crisis in Mosul and the rise of the caliphate in order to lock down Kirkuk and say, that's it. We're keeping it. And so they're certainly laying down their marker. Anyway, and the Iraqi government, the Iraqi army and Shiite militias are already, I don't know if they're declaring defeat, but they've been trying very hard for 3 weeks to take Tikrit and haven't gotten anywhere other than withdrawn. You know, they occupied part of a campus, a university campus there in Tikrit for a while, and then they turned around and left again. They just don't have the power to dominate the Sunni parts of the country, which, I think, as we've talked about on the show for 10 years now, is, you know, basically the Iranian program all along is to, you know, as they always promoted through the Supreme Islamic Council and the Dawa Party, they wanted, quote, federalism, you know, meaning ultimately they're not that concerned about trying to impose their way on the Sunni-dominated areas of Iraq because it's just too much trouble. They don't have the power to do it. They don't want to fight another Iran-Iraq war. They want to get along with the Iraqis they get along with and let there be a new line, even if it's kind of a soft one for a while. That's been their policy. In fact, maybe this sounds stupid to some, but also it helps kind of get to the point for me anyway, is this is part of the Tom Clancy story, one of them from right around the time of September 11th, actually. I forget which one it was. I read two or three of those back then. And so there's one of them where the Iranian sleeper cell agent shoots Saddam in the back of the head and kills him. Regime change in Iraq. And Iran immediately inherits the south of the country from Baghdad to Basra. And then while the Ayatollah is doing his master plan against America, he's having his deputies handle the problem of what to do about Sunni Iraq and getting them to abide by all the rules that the new Islamists coming to power in Sunni Iraq would have, and how to work all the compromises. And in the story, it actually just serves as like his annoyance that he's outsourced these decisions about what to do about the occupation of Iraq to his inferiors, but it keeps turning out to be, and it's distracting him from his evil plot against us, right? But it turns out that he has major crises in the takeover of Iraq. Now that he owns the south of the country, what's he going to do about the rest of it? The Kurds are restless, and the Sunnis are restive, and there's a big problem. Anyway, so just to go to show how much all of this could have been predicted, you know, Mitchell Prothero, who we interviewed yesterday on the show, his last piece is about the Christians being kicked out of Mosul. Well, they've lived for 2,000 years. And the very last of them are fleeing in terror from the Islamic State. And at the end, the quote is, "God damn George Bush. This is all his fault. Because he toppled Saddam Hussein." And, of course, he was oversimplifying it. It's not just that George Bush toppled Saddam Hussein, which, you know, if he'd just done that and left the next day, who knows what would have happened. Maybe it would have been just as bad, I don't know. But what we do know is he stayed for 9 years and got 1 million people killed in a massive civil war and ran a government of proportional representation, which guaranteed civil war. Got 1 million people killed, smashed their entire society, hardened every hatred into full-scale enemy status. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about commodity discs from CommodityDiscs.com. They're one-ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code Commodity Disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's CommodityDiscs.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Right now at The Nation, they've just put out this article debunking 5 Israeli talking points. Oh, they pulled out of Gaza in 2005 and Hamas started it with their rockets and all the crap that you hear all day that's not true at all. But here's the one I want to focus on, and it's the most important of all. List number 5. Again, this is at thenation.com. Hamas hides its weapons in homes, mosques, and schools and uses human shields. This, writes The Nation, is arguably one of Israel's most insidious claims because it blames Palestinians for their own death and deprives them of even their victimhood. Israel made the same argument in its war. Yeah, it's also them writing themselves a blank check to go ahead and murder civilians and claim that every single one was only put in harm's way by some, you know, phantom enemy. Israel made the same argument in its war against Lebanon in 2006 and in its war against Palestinians in 2008. notwithstanding its military cartoon sketches, Colin Powell, Israel has yet to prove that Hamas has used civilian infrastructure to store military weapons. The two cases where Hamas indeed stored weapons in United Nations schools, the schools were empty. The UN discovered the rockets themselves and publicly condemned the violation of its sanctity. International human rights organizations that have investigated these claims have determined that they are not true. It attributed the high death toll in Israel's 2006 war on Lebanon to Israel's indiscriminate attacks. And that's a link there to amnesty.org. Human Rights Watch notes, quote, the evidence Human Rights Watch uncovered in its on-the-ground investigations, this is the Lebanon, 2006 Lebanon war, refutes Israel's argument. We found strong evidence that Hezbollah stored most of its rockets in bunkers and weapons storage facilities located in uninhabited fields and valleys, and that in the vast majority of the cases, Hezbollah fighters left populated civilian areas as soon as the fighting started, and that Hezbollah fired the vast majority of its rockets from pre-prepared positions outside villages. In fact, that's end quote from Human Rights Watch. In fact, continues The Nation, only Israeli soldiers have systematically used Palestinians as human shields. Since Israel's incursion into the West Bank in 2002, it has used Palestinians as human shields by tying young Palestinians onto the hoods of their cars and trucks or forcing them to go into a home where a potential militant may be hiding. Just last night, I read tweets from a Palestinian journalist in Gaza saying the IDF has taken up a position on the opposite side of an inhabited apartment home and they will not let the people leave the house. And then they're firing over their heads toward their victims, and the victims cannot return fire without risking the lives of the innocent people stuck in between. Again, the Israelis are the ones using human shields, and that's a proven fact that they have tied Palestinian children even to the hoods of their trucks for a little bit extra bulletproof there as they accuse their enemies of using human shields. Even assuming that Israel's claims were plausible, humanitarian law obligates Israel to avoid civilian casualties that, quote, would be excessive in relation to the concrete and direct military advantage anticipated, which is pretty bad in itself, obviously. A belligerent force must verify whether civilian or civilian infrastructure qualifies as a military objective. In the case of doubt, quote, whether an object which is normally dedicated to civilian purposes, such as a place of worship, a house or other dwelling or a school, is being used to make an effective contribution to military action, it shall be presumed not to be so used. End quote. And that's Lincoln to the Red Cross and the applicable quotes from the Geneva Conventions there. In over 3 weeks of its military program, Israel has demolished 3,175 homes, at least a dozen with families inside, destroyed five hospitals, and six clinics. Partially damaged 64 mosques and two churches, partially to completely destroyed eight government ministries, injured 4,620, and killed over 700 Palestinians. At plain sight, these numbers indicate Israel's egregious violations of humanitarian law, ones that amount to war crimes. Of course, at the same time, oh, look at us, we're the most high-tech, fancy-pants, laser-guided military in the world. We take the most care to fulfill exactly these obligations, claim the Israelis in their PR. They don't deny the authority or anything like that. They just say, yeah, of course, we are as pinpoint as can possibly be, and yet the numbers prove, and the screams, and the massive piles of grief prove that they're lying. Beyond the body count and reference to law, which is a product of power, the question to ask is, what is Israel's end goal? What if Hamas and Islamic Jihad dug tunnels beneath the entirety of the Gaza Strip? They clearly did not, but let us assume they did for the sake of argument. According to Israel's logic, all of Gazans, 1.8 million Palestinians, are therefore human shields, just for being born Palestinian in Gaza. Yeah, or being born Palestinian in Israel and being kicked out of Israel for not being Jewish. As I forgot who tweets that all the time puts it. According to Israel, yeah, anyone in Gaza is fair game. As long as there's a tunnel, you know, somewhere near them, maybe. The solution is to destroy the 360-kilometer square strip of land and to expect a watching world to accept this catastrophic loss as incidental. This is possible only by framing and accepting the dehumanization of Palestinian life. Despite the absurdity of this proposal, it is precisely what Israeli society is urging its military leadership to do. Israel cannot bomb Palestinians into submission, and it certainly cannot bomb them into peace. You got that right. So that's Sharif Abdel Kudus at The Nation. It says, read next. A hospital in Gaza overwhelmed with victims of Israeli attacks. Oh, I'm sorry. I gave the credit to the wrong person. I thought it was the author of the next article was the author of this one, too. This is by Noura Erekat. Noura Erekat at thenation.com. Brand new. 5 Israeli talking points in Gaza debunked. And there on the human shields, prove it. UN school this, UN school that, not the ones they've been attacking full of innocent victims. Only an empty UN school, and the UN said, oh, here, and gave up the weapons and denounced Hamas for hiding them there for a minute. And anyway, that's it. So, I don't know. Here's the thing. I guess I gotta make this about America, or no one even cares, right? Never mind those innocent Arab lives. Never mind tiny children screaming horribly wounded as they die or any of that, you know, nonsensical, worthless information. How about Israel's treatment of the Palestinians generates terrorist attacks against the United States and has for 20 years now? More. Ramzi Youssef, when the guy that cooked the bomb for the first World Trade Center attack, wrote a letter to the New York Times, said, I did it, and I did it because of Palestine. I'm the Palestinian Liberation Army. He was speaking on behalf, really, of Egyptian Islamic Jihad, was the group that he was with, that he, you know, cooked the bomb for, but I guess he, you know, had his own interests there. And that was his thing. He said, this is all about Israel and all about American support for the Egyptian dictatorship, in order to allow the Israelis to continue their crimes against the people of Palestine. And that's how this whole terror war really started. And all along, as Michael Shorey, the chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, the former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, put it on this show the other day, on this show, this week. Yeah, that's right. Israel's war crimes against the Palestinians, what they do, and he actually even supported some of what they do, funny enough, but he said, for their interest's sake, but he said, for our interest's sake, it makes no sense to take responsibility for arming and financing the Israelis to do these things, because it generates attacks against the United States up to, and yes, including the September 11th attack on America. So we got at least a question whether that's worth it in real context.